Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the Walmart shooting in Hobart, the BMV offices will be closed in observance of the Columbus Day holiday, Sharon Jackson reports on economic development opportunities in Gary, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with hospitality industry leader and author Joakima Hiller. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The deadline to register to vote in the November 6th general election is 1 week away. The Secretary of State's office says Indiana residents can register to vote online by October 9th by texting Indiana to 2Vote, that's 28683, or visit indianavoters.com. Residents can also submit an application to register in person at their local county clerk's office. To be eligible to register to vote, residents must be a U.S. citizen, at least 18 years old by election day, reside in their precinct for at least 30 days before the election, and not currently imprisoned after being convicted of a crime. The Indiana Voters app allows Hoosiers to confirm their voter registration, look up their polling place, get driving directions, and learn who's on their ballot.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
The hospitality giant White Lodging, that owns or operates dozens of hotels around the country, is planning a $356 million mixed-use development along one of Northwest Indiana's busiest highway interchanges. White Lodging announced Tuesday that 40 acres at the I-65 and US 30 interchange in Merrillville would be redeveloped to include an event center, hotels, restaurants, an office building, and housing. The Times reports the farm at the Crossroad Commons would replace the former Radisson Hotel and the Star Plaza Theater and a still-standing office complex. The Merrillville-based company says it will cover two-thirds of the project's cost. It's asking municipal, county, and state governments to contribute the remaining third. White Lodging Chairman Bruce White says the project, quote, will serve as a long-standing anchor for economic development in the region.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
The Gary Common Council voted Tuesday to withdraw its demand that subpoenas be issued to some city officials to get documents related to a fire department special fund for emergency medical services expenses. The Post Tribune reports an investigation conducted by a private accounting firm at the request of Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson had determined that some $8.1 million had been improperly transferred from the fund to cover other government expenses, with just over half of that covering city payroll. Councilwoman Lavetta Sparks-Wade has said she believes that is inadequate and that the Common Council ought to conduct their own investigation. That led the council to overwhelmingly approve her request last month for subpoenas to be issued to require documents related to the fire department's EMS fund to be turned over to them. But Common Council Attorney Renzer Williams on Tuesday informed council members that while they have the authority to issue subpoenas, they do not have automatic authority to enforce them. They would have needed to get an outside judge to authorize their request for it to have any binding authority. The council then voted to rescind the request. All council members except for Sparks-Wade voted to rescind. Sparks-Wade said she still thinks her way of handling the issue was the correct one. In fact, she said she'd like to amend her original request to get copies of text messages sent by government officials related to the EMS fund, formerly known as Fund 224. The mayor's office complied last week to the request, sending electronic copies of all related documents to all Common Council members.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
According to police and court records, the 25-year-old man shot Sunday at Walmart has been wounded in three separate shootings since his release from prison in June. The Gary man charged Tuesday with shooting Kyron Hawthorne Sr. and his 9-year-old son at the Hobart Walmart had been awaiting sentencing for misdemeanor possession of cocaine in a 2016 case where police also seized an AK-47 and a Glock handgun. The Times reports 26-year-old Alex Hughes and Hawthorne belong to rival gangs in Gary's Glen Park neighborhood. Police have said the father, who also is from Gary, was wounded in a shooting about 6 weeks ago in Gary. After Sunday's shooting, people took shelter in the store as officers responded.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Governor Eric Holcomb joined city leaders from across the state to talk about infrastructure and connectivity in the Hoosier State. Holcomb's appearance took place at the French Lick Springs Hotel during a convention of mayors and city officials that are part of an organization called AIM, Accelerating Indiana's Municipalities. Holcomb spoke about bringing in new industry to Indiana towns to ensure the future economic vitality of the state.
We have to make sure that you have safe streets and good schools, all the basics. But then in addition to that, people are looking for cool places to live. We know that population scarcity is one of the biggest threats that we face as a state.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Bureau of Motor Vehicles says all of its licensed branches will be closed Saturday through Monday in observance of the Columbus Day holiday. It says licensed branches will resume regularly scheduled business hours on Tuesday. It says Indiana residents can visit www.in.gov/BMV for a complete list of branch locations and hours, to complete an online transaction, or to find a 24-hour BMV Connect kiosk.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
U.S. Senator for Indiana Todd Young is backing legislation that would help keep lead out of drinking water in low-income homes. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, it would give the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, more authority to address the problem.
Young says HUD already oversees lead paint remediation in homes paid for with federal assistance.
We thought that it would be a natural fit to require grant recipients to also test for lead in drinking water.
The bill, called the Get the Lead Out of Assisted Housing Act of 2018, would also help communities address lead in drinking water in other public spaces, like daycare centers and schools. Representatives from both parties helped introduce the legislation. Young says he's confident the bill will be signed into law in the coming months. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state's top education official announced Monday she will not seek a second term. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports this could mean the next person to hold the office will be appointed by the governor.
After discussing her 2019 priorities, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick dropped a bit of a bombshell. She's not running for re-election. McCormick entered office after years of turmoil between education policymakers and agencies. During her first months on the job, the General Assembly voted to make the position an appointment from the governor instead of an elected office. And she says political noise around that has taken attention away from what's being done for students.
It is detracting from the good work that we're trying to do and that local schools are trying to do.
Indiana's governor is set to appoint a Secretary of Education in 2025, but McCormick's decision could mean that lawmakers move that up to 2021. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The state's school chief has an aggressive legislative agenda for 2019, despite her surprise announcement that she doesn't plan to run for re-election. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay has more on what issues Jennifer McCormick's department will advocate for during the upcoming session.
A recurring theme of Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick's agenda for next year is accountability. She wants charter schools and their authorizers to be held more accountable for school quality. She also wants more inclusive practices in schools taking public dollars, particularly for the LGBT community.
Our concern is we still have schools that are allowed to have policies that are exclusionary of kids that fall under that umbrella, and we don't think that's acceptable.
McCormick also says she'll push for a single school accountability system aligned with the federal one. McCormick also has her sights set on an increase in funding for pre-K, STEM, and special education. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
When no new farm bill was approved by the U.S. House Sunday night, the previous legislation lapsed, even though it's traditionally been touted by both parties as a must-pass piece of legislation. But Indiana Farm Bureau President Randy Cron says that hasn't been the case this time around.
We've always kept the farm bill above the political fray and all the issues going on. And now it seems like it's kind of getting drawn in to the rest of the politics and partisanship.
One sticking point is House Republicans' desire to add work requirements for the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, commonly known as food stamps. That's the largest segment of the farm bill, but the law also funds a variety of programs that help agricultural workers across the country. Kron says not knowing what the new law will entail makes planning for next season worrisome for some farmers like himself.
On our farm, we're making decisions for next year already, and we really don't know what the rules of the game are going to be without a farm bill.
The inaugural farm bill was passed in 1933 under President Franklin Roosevelt's administration and has traditionally been renewed every 5 years.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A coalition of groups working to preserve the Affordable Care Act has two stops in Indiana on its first nationwide bus tour this week. Jessica Hogg, a 23-year-old cancer survivor from Indianapolis, is on board the Protect Our Care bus. She is worried about Republican efforts to dismantle the ACA, especially as it relates to pre-existing conditions.
People can't control when they get a disease or get asthma. It's not something that you can control. It's just something that happens within your life.
The group estimates more than 2.7 million Hoosiers have a pre-existing condition. The bus tour also focuses on efforts to promote so-called junk plans and the reduction of enrollment outreach. The tour stopped in South Bend on Wednesday.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
If you've been down the beer aisle lately, you've probably noticed the growing number of barrel-aged beers. The popularity of the drinks means there's more demand for used barrels. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brosher reports, that's creating new business opportunities for distilleries and turning an underground industry mainstream.
As you step into Upland Brewing Company's wood shop in Bloomington, it quickly becomes clear where the building got its name. Upland President Pete Batuli stands toward the back end of the shop, where wooden wine barrels line the walls from floor to ceiling.
A lot of our growth the last couple of years has come from our sour program and barrel-aged beers.
Upland opened the wood shop 2 years ago to help support its growing sour ales program. Unlike other styles of beer, brewers purposely introduced wild yeast or bacteria during the fermentation process. That's what gives sours their tangy flavor. And wooden barrels are an essential component. Upland formed a partnership with Oliver Winery more than a decade ago, trading a few cases of beer for a few wine barrels. Batuli says they use them as fermentation vessels.
So the microorganisms live inside the wood, and we need the barrels to really be kind of neutral. We don't want a ton of flavor. We just need a vessel for this really amazing fermentation.
But you can also find some barrels at Upland's production facility, where it brews its clean or non-sour beers. Zach Allgood is the head brewer here. He uses spirit barrels to add unique flavors to certain brews. Bourbon barrels are most common, but he even has beer aging in a couple of peated scotch barrels.
Typically, spirit barrels, the alcohol content is high enough that there's nothing in there that can contaminate the beer. And we will just fill those barrels with fermented beer and let it sit, typically 6 months to a year. And after about 6 months, we'll start tasting them, seeing where they are and making the decision on whether these beers are done yet or whether they need more time to mellow out.
In addition to Oliver, Upland has a good relationship with a few Kentucky distillers. So oftentimes getting a barrel is as easy as making a phone call. But they can be much harder to find for breweries that don't have those relationships.
It's like becoming a detective to try and find it.
That's Noah Steingraber. He's in charge of national and international craft sales for Kentucky Bourbon Barrel in Louisville. He fields a lot of calls from brewers around the world looking for specific barrels. It's his job to track them down using his network of contacts. When they first arrive, coopers inspect them. Then they make any necessary repairs. A job that requires great skill and strength. The coopers work in the middle of a giant warehouse, replacing the wooden staves or metal hoops on the barrels. While most of the barrels they repair held bourbon or whiskey, Steingraber says brewers are increasingly on the hunt for more unique vessels.
So it's interesting to see how it's continued to evolve, not just from bourbon, but into other barrels such as wine, rum, tequila, maple syrup, hot sauce. You know, there's so many different things out there.
The cost of buying barrels can add up quickly, with some running well into the hundreds of dollars. Like with most businesses, it's cheaper to buy the barrels in bulk. But many brewers don't have the necessary capital or the storage space. That's creating an opportunity for more regional and local partnerships between beverage makers. Hotel Tango in Indianapolis makes several different spirits, including bourbon and whiskey. Founder and CEO Travis Barnes says they recently started partnering with local breweries.
We learned early on that, one, we didn't have a very big marketing or advertising budget, and this was an easy way and an effective way to get our name out among folks that wouldn't necessarily have ever heard of us.
The distillery is getting an increasing number of requests for its used barrels. And while acting as a broker isn't something master distiller Eric Stauffer says they initially planned for, it's mutually beneficial.
We'll provide them with some of our bourbon barrels for use in aging things like porters or stouts or IPAs. And then on the backside, we will then get some of those new barrels back and age some of our bourbons. We'll finish them than in some of the porters or the stouts barrels that we would get from the breweries.
It's an opportunity he expects more distillers will start raising their glasses to. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana Interim City Committee on Commerce and Economic Development has discovered some opportunities for the city of Gary that can be pursued. Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson recently hosted the committee to explore economic opportunities in a specific area of the city, as she tells Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson what came out of that meeting.
Your Indiana Study Committee on Commerce and Economic Development meeting, did your meeting guests identify any kind of economic opportunities that you wanted to pursue specifically?
We did. Actually, the committee met at the airport, but we were really focused on the multimodal opportunities with an eye towards the port area, not so much as the water aspect of the port, although that was a part of the discussion as it relates to barges, but also to discuss the port as an opportunity for more industrial development and light manufacturing, given the number of acres that are available over there, the type of manufacturers that are already in our Buffington Harbor area, specifically Carmuth Lime, Praxair, and the fact that we have now seen almost the completion of the demolition of the Dean Mitchell Power Plant and Lehigh Cement Plant, so that leaves space available for development. And, you know, the discussion was very much, is the fact that we have a casino in that footprint the highest and best use of the land? So all of that was a part of the discussion. We are in the process of doing a study that looks a little closer at the Buffington Harbor area, but many of the legislators were really surprised to see the proximity of water, rail, highway, and air, of course, with the airport. So I was extremely pleased not only with the deliberations, but also I'm very hopeful about the results of the study and ultimately the discussion during the next meeting, which will be held down in Indianapolis on October 15th.
When you were talking to them, what did you show off in terms of the examples of the economic development work that you've already done with the airport and the surrounding area?
Well, I think the thing that we were best able to do is show how public investment, specifically in the airport runway expansion and some of the work that has been done on the airport aprons, on airport roads, has specifically led to over $25 million in private investment at the airport. So when we invest public dollars, that really does spur local development. And that doesn't even address some of the investment that's been done in the footprints. For example, Carmouche Lime has expanded their operation. You have Vexor Manufacturing, a waste-to-energy company that has come online since the airport has expanded, not necessarily because of the expansion, but because they understand how valuable that corridor on Airport Road is.
Do you think Gary will get any new industry from the meeting and the presentation that you did on Buffington Harbor?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that, you know, that's certainly underway because of the fact that we have a new industrial road that will take trucks into Buffington Harbor, and that's already being constructed. And so given the fact that that is a work in progress, to be able to talk about that will not only garner new companies, but I think it will also encourage legislators to think a lot more concertedly about how they can give us tools, such as tools for remediation, that would make it a lot easier for companies to locate there.
You mentioned the meeting that you have coming up in October down in Indianapolis. Yeah. And so what are your economic development plans moving forward?
Well, we'll continue to focus on an asset-based plan. And what I mean by that is to focus on our transportation assets, to focus on our university asset in terms of Indiana University Northwest and the IU Medical School, to focus on the area around Methodist Hospital, the downtown area, which features a nationally recognized public art project, the Bloomberg awarded project Art House of Social Kitchen. We'll focus on the Marquette Park, which is certainly one of our investment areas. And then we'll continue to build on our partnerships with the RDA, with local corporations like NIPSCO and U.S. Steel, with members of the General Assembly, as well as other local elected officials. And by working on all of those things at the same time, that it will result in a continued investment in Gary.
Well, thank you so much, Mayor. I really appreciate your time, and thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. I'm glad to do it.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with hospitality industry leader Joakima Hiller.
Joakima Hiller got her degree from Purdue University Calumet, and we'll find out more about that in a moment, as a professional in the hospitality industry. And she's had a lot to learn over the years, and she's been able to put all that learning to good use. She has written three books, all of which are available online if you'd like to check them out. And she's had to deal not only with a great deal of change in her professional life, but unfortunately in her personal life as well, too. And we're going to find out more. Joakima Hiller, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about yourself professionally. How did you make it all these years in the hospitality industry? You started out, I guess, at a very young age, I understand.
Yes. Actually, I'm an Army brat and traveled quite extensively with my family. And I remember leaving the hotel room for the day and then coming back later on and realizing that the bed had been made. And I vividly remember asking my mom, "What happened? Who made our bed? You didn't make us make the bed this morning," not realizing that there was an entire department, you know, called housekeeping, that was their responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Or we would go down for breakfast in the morning, and then we would leave, and I would go, "Oh, Daddy, you didn't pay for breakfast," not realizing that because of the type of hotel it was, the rate of the breakfast was included in the overall hotel stay. So to me, hotels very early on began to represent magic, where things would happen and I wouldn't have any idea as to how they occurred. So probably as early as 10, if someone had asked me, "What do you want to be, young lady, when you grow up?" I would say that I wanted to work in a hotel. And I got that opportunity when I was about 15 years old. And I've never looked back.
Now, you have taken on what jobs over the years now, working in hotels and in the hospitality industry?
Sure.
Sure. At 15, I was very fortunate to start out in the human resources department of a full-service hotel, so I got a chance to learn the different positions, work in most of the different departments to learn a little bit more, and then I transitioned after graduating from college into management and became the assistant reservation sales manager for the Radisson Hotel at Star Plaza that used to be in Merrillville, Indiana. And there I got a chance to actually work with entertainers as well. And then I transitioned to the front office department as front desk manager. And then I was afforded the opportunity to assist in the opening of Trump Hotel Casino as the front office manager. And then I got out on the road and became a traveling trainer for a global hotel company and got a chance to go all over the world, Hong Kong, Canada, all throughout the United States, Paris. And then I became an aunt, and I wanted to come back and settle down at home so that I could make an impact in their life. And so I began managing, or helped open and manage, the Country Inn & Suites in Portage, Indiana, and worked there for about a year, and then transitioned to working or taking over a hotel in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I transitioned into education.
And then you became, I guess, what I guess best called a hospitality educator. What kind of job did you have a chance to be able to do in that particular role?
Sure. In Indianapolis, there was a culinary college, and the students could get an associate's degree in culinary arts. And what happened is they started to get out into the industry and realized that they needed more. They needed more education. They needed a bachelor's degree. So I was recruited to help begin the bachelor's program for this culinary college, where students could walk out of that degree with their background not only in culinary arts, but then in the business education classes within hospitality and go into management to continue their career. And then when I decided to go back to college myself and pursue my doctorate, I realized that a good environment for me would be at the university level, and that's when I relocated to Springfield, Missouri.
Now, we mentioned at the start of our conversation that you're the author, co-author, I guess, because you've had had an assistant who has worked in the hotel industry, Jill Woods, with you on the books. You had three books that you've worked on. The first one, I understand, was one that was very specifically designed for people who are either learning the hospitality industry or they're actually working in it on a daily basis. And it's a very important guide, I think, that helps out. First, tell us a little bit about that book.
Sure. It's called The Rev Park Formula, and Jill and I worked at the last hotel that I managed there in Indianapolis, and boy, did we have some challenges. And so when she took over as general manager, we at this point had bonded so that and been through so much that we were really good friends. And so one day we thought, oh my goodness, all the stories we have, all the experiences we have, we should write a book. And we sat down at her kitchen table, and we mapped out a guidebook, the RevPAR formula, which really the formula is optimizing challenging circumstances plus always driving retention equals an increase in revenue per available room. Mm-hmm. So if you really take those challenges that you are given, and we map out 10 of those challenges based on what was going on at the time in the industry, if you take those challenges and you really work on retaining your employees and turning those challenges around, then you will have an increase in a monetary increase, your revenue per available room, which is a hotel concept that we have. Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that first book came out in April of 2011. In May of 2015, you and Jill got together and you worked on a second book, which is entitled Seven Easy Ways to Show Your Employees You Care. Because obviously you had a chance not only to take all the experience that you had in the hospitality industry, but the experience that you had working in the personnel side, I guess, the human relations side in all this, too.
Yes.
What did you be able to meld together from everything that you learned to be able to create the second book?
Sure. Well, what happened with this one is I had relocated to Missouri,
And now I have students at this time. So in my conversations with my students and then also reconnecting with my colleagues back in Indianapolis, it seemed like every conversation I had would end with either the student or my colleague saying, oh, man, you know, I love my job, but I really wish someone cared. I really wish my supervisor cared about me. And that just really got to me. I mean, it got to my heart, and I thought, what can I do with that? I feel like there's something I should be doing with that information. And so one day I thought, why don't I write a love letter to all of the other managers that are out there? And so 7 easy ways to show your employees you care is sort of like my message, my personal message, my love letter to all the other managers that are out there saying, hey, I know you're working hard, but we've really got to make sure that we make an impact in the lives of the employees that we have. And here's how. I map out 7 ways to go about doing that, mm-hmm. to make them feel cared for, to make them feel special.
Now, finally, the latest book that is out there, and by the way, we should mention, too, that all 3 of the books are available on Amazon.com. The latest book is entitled The Red Book, Notes from a First-Year General Manager. And I understand in this latest book, you and Jill get together, and you're able to really, really tear the facade off. You know, you're unmasking an awful lot of things that people that maybe that even are currently working in the hospitality industry don't really know about, because these are things that you experienced in the first year that you had to work as a hotel manager.
Yes, this one is very different from our first one. It's not a guide. It's just really a compilation of the experiences that we had together, some separately. But we have created a character named Jackson. And Jackson graduates from college, and he has his first interview for a general manager's job out in the industry. And he receives it. He gets the job. And so we map out his first year in management as that general manager, and we tell everything. So each of the stories and the experiences that Jackson incurs are actually true stories that have happened with Jill and I. And it gets pretty wild. We really have had situations, just to give you a little insight from the book, is, you know, we've had to deal with guests who have passed away in the room. So we tackle that, and I know in just speaking with my students, that's something that they don't ever think about. And I'm going, you know, that's why we did the book, because we want everyone to know that these are things that we handle. Mm-hmm. Also, we take it from the perspective that when you work in the service industry, unfortunately, the public thinks that you are not knowledgeable, that you're not intelligent. But when you think about everything that we have to know to run a hotel, we are some pretty intelligent people, from, you know, the chemistry side on how to mix chemicals in the housekeeping department, to, you know, customer service, to how to handle, you know, your swimming pool area and complaints. So, you know, we're not just, you know, people who are cleaning rooms. We clean rooms, and we do a whole list of other things as well.
It's interesting that you should bring up in the book and your experiences here about the unfortunate incident of a guest passing away in a room, because we know that if you're a fan of Monty Python's Flying Circus and you remember John Cleese, who was one of the key members of the group, he went on, of course, to come up with an entire series of his own that got its own famous role in television, Fawlty Towers. And he was able, he and his co-writer, who at the time was his wife, came up with this episode of a guest dying in a room, and what Basil Fawlty does to try to get around all that and not let anybody else know something bad happened. So,
right.
So that was taken from real life too, just as I understand that apparently Mr. Fawlty, Mr. Cleese actually came up with when they created that particular episode. So, yeah, so there's all kinds of interesting things I can see that you deal with in real life in the hospitality industry. And it's only fair that people starting out in the industry, or people that are just outside the industry, need to know about what goes on within the four walls of a hotel.
Yes, definitely.
Now, you mentioned you're now a hospitality instructor at Missouri State University. You're able to bring things together. But, of course, you got your college experience with Purdue University Calumet, the Hammond campus, in the program, which many people know as RHI, which is Restaurant, Hotel, Institutional, and Tourism Management. One of the things that I know in particular that the campus tries to deal with is trying to get students involved, and you had this opportunity, of course, in real life by learning, by doing, working in the hospitality industry, is to come up with ways to be able to teach future students things that they need to know. Maybe they won't have the benefit of getting to work in a hotel, but in the future, the university, I know, is working on a way to take advantage of some of its most famous property down at West Lafayette, the Union Club Hotel, which is in the Purdue Memorial Union Building on the main campus, and they're going to do some major expansion. And one of the things they talk about they want to do in that expansion project is what you, I'm sure, are very much familiar with is experiential learning. Tell us what you feel experiential learning is and how maybe, you, in your view, what Purdue wants to do down in West Lafayette will fit in well down there.
Sure. First, I just want to say thank you to the White family for making such a donation. I think any opportunity we have to provide experiential learning for students, that it is a really wonderful thing to do. One of the things that is still what I call king or queen in the hospitality industry is experience. So one of the things that Jackson in the Red Book, the latest book that I have published, experiences is that once you graduate from college, that doesn't necessarily mean that you are qualified to be a manager or a supervisor in the hospitality industry. And that's because your employer is still going to look for experience. Have you cleaned rooms? Have you cooked something in a kitchen? Have you managed a kitchen? Have you had your hands on the actual thing that you'll be doing in the industry? And then have you interacted with customers? And so in the classroom, whether it is, you know, in a culinary class or even in an introduction to lodging management class, we try to provide students an opportunity to actually do those things. For example, in my special event planning class, my students get a chance to actually make invitations, you know, to actually do the things that they would be responsible for doing in planning an event.
Mm-hmm. Very
and
interesting.
So I think, you know, the White family should be applauded by providing that opportunity with, you know, the hotel there in West Lafayette. It only enhances the educational impact for those students and provides them an opportunity to be like Jackson in the Red Book,
yeah,
which is to step right into a management position now that he has his education and he's had experience by having an internship.
We're talking with Dr. Joachima Hiller. She is a professor in hospitality and is a graduate of Purdue University Calumet, and she got her master's in business administration from Keller Graduate School of Management. And you've been working, of course, now making it up the academic ladder, working as a professor in other states and your other experience as well, to be able to put all that together and work very hard to get your PhD, which I know is the ultimate goal that anybody that has made it so far out of graduate school with a master's, they want to make that next step for in their career and financially as well as professionally. And you have had a number of personal problems along the way. Tell us a little bit about some of these that have seemed to have slowed you down, I guess, in trying to be able to achieve that PhD.
Sure. I started working on my doctorate in about 2013 from the advice of my professors at Purdue. They said, you know, if you want to continue if you want to continue working at the university level, you really need to have a doctorate.
Right.
And so I started in 2013 as a distance doctoral student through Iowa State University. They have an awesome program. And right about a year or two into the program, I became ill, and one of the results of my illness was having my right leg amputated above the knee. So I don't have a knee. And it really not just slowed me down, but it changed every single aspect of my life. And I went from not wanting to live without a leg to, you know, working my way to thinking, okay, maybe I can do this and maybe I can be useful and maybe I can get back on my educational journey and get my doctorate. And just a couple of days ago, I got the final word from my major professor at Iowa State saying I had met all of the conditions for my doctorate. So I'm feeling really good right now.
Wow, I would imagine so. Yes, that's great. Now that you've gotten the word that you're going to actually get your PhD degree, when do you get to wear the gown and the cap and actually go through the ceremony to get that, much as I hate to say it, the sheepskin, you know? When do you get that diploma in hand?
It will be this fall. Now, I probably won't participate in the commencement exercises, but I have a very large family, and so I want to do some sort of graduation party or open house. And I want to do it in three different cities, so I'm probably going to do something here in Missouri, and then I'll probably go to Indianapolis, where I ended my career in a hotel there.
Right.
So I'd love to do something with my colleagues there to celebrate. And then I got to go home. So I'll probably do something in Gary, Indiana as well, so that my parents can participate.
That's great. Joachim, if there is anything in particular, and you've done a lot of this, and obviously you've actually put it in writing because you've written three books that detail a lot of this information, if there is something that you could pass along to somebody who is interested in the hospitality industry, and maybe somebody, as we said, maybe somebody who's out there in the trenches right now on the front line, they're either at the front desk or they're somebody working back in the kitchen or they're a housekeeper or in some other task that's part of the hotel business, what would you tell them?
Sure. You know, I probably have two really key pieces of advice that helped me sustain a 20-plus year career in the industry. And the first thing is you've got to really love people. Not necessarily like them, because they're going to test you, not only from a coworker and employee and supervisor standpoint, but from a guest standpoint. You just really got to love people. That's got to be the core from which you operate, so that when things do go wrong, you can still maintain your decorum, because it's the very base of things. You know, you have a genuine love and care for people. And then the second thing is, when things really get tough, you need to be able to reconnect with your reason why. Why did you get into the hospitality industry? You know, what brought you here? And I know for me, I can always go back to being that little girl who returned at the end of the day and said, "Oh, Mom, who made the bed? How did that happen?" That little girl is still in me, and she is what drives my passion for the industry for today. So I think that would be my two key pieces of advice. You got to love people, or you won't last very long in this people-driven industry. And then secondly, you've got to always be able to reconnect with your reason why you got into the industry. What's driving your passion?
Well, I guess it shows that you come full circle from those thoughts, whether you say when you were a little girl and you saw the mystery of how a bed was rumpled the night before and is nice and clean and neat today.
Yes.
And how that has changed and turned into a career, and with all the problems along the way that you've been able to turn that around into not only being a successful educator, but also a successful author with three books out there, the latest of which is entitled The Red Book, Notes from a First-Year General Manager. And all three books that you have worked with Joe Woods on out there available and at Amazon.com. If you're interested, if you're sincere about wanting to be in the hospitality industry, you got to get all three copies, because I'm sure that you're going to learn something very important from what you get out of all three. Joachim Hiller, thanks very much for being with us. It's been a very, very interesting conversation, and the best of luck to you in the future, especially as you're being an official professor now, I guess, or a full-fledged professor coming up here with receiving your PhD soon, and for everything that you have done in your life and be able to teach young people coming up through the ranks and the importance of helping other people in such an important industry as the hospitality industry. Thank you for being with us to talk about today.
Thank you so much.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link.
For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.